letter, the list of hints for legislators? Did you get that copy?
Please. Today is March 7th, 2011. The work session, House Bill 2940, will not be heard today. We have a fiscal issue on that one. The first hearing today will be on House Bill, open a public hearing on House Bill 2955. Representative Fredericks, please. And with the overflow crowd, I believe there's an overflow space right one floor below us there. They'll have a TV going in the right outside the Senate chamber. So usually the fire marshal doesn't like people standing, and we'll be moving on to the next bill after we get through this one. And I know most of the people are here for the next two. Representative Fredericks, please.
Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, how are you?
I am
Representative Lou Frederick from District 43, North and Northeast Portland, and I believe you have my memo describing the thinking behind this bill, so I wanted to talk at least a little bit more about it. I introduced House Bill 2955 because of repeated incidents in my community that are heartbreaking from start to finish.
We've seen encounters between the police and individuals in crisis end in death repeatedly. These deaths are obviously devastating to the families of the dead, but they're also devastating to the officers involved, to their colleagues, and to the community. They undermine the community's trust in the police, both individual officers and the institution. That tension affects every encounter between citizens and police. They've also led to a number of expensive civil settlements with the families. We feel that finding a better way is not optional. It's an emergency. When I hear prominent members of the community, including, for example, a judge and a newspaper publisher, counsel against contacting the police if a loved one is in crisis, I know we've got a problem. I've got to let you in on a secret. Black families teach their children how to interact with the police and never stop worrying that an encounter will take a bad turn. In my research on this topic, I've discovered that there's a wide disparity around the state in protocols and training regarding encounters with individuals in crisis. The most important takeaway is that the best practices currently taught by the DPSST are not consistently reaching the practicing officers, that there is consequently a wide disparity of practices on the street. Specifically, there are officers who employ a ladder of escalating force so that noncompliance leads to progressively more aggressive response from the officer. And others employ strategies of de-escalation, both creating and taking advantage of opportunities to lower the tension level, diffuse the situation, and get the individual the help or he or she needs. Probably don't need to tell you that there's a difference in the outcomes from these two approaches. Now, I do not argue that all situations can be diffused without resort to force. We've all heard that saying that every problem is a nail if your only tool is a hammer. We need to make sure that our police officers hit the street every day with a full toolbox. I understand that there are dangerous people in the world, and the police officers are trained to protect the rest of us. But I believe that we can do better, and that individuals in crisis need protection too. I want to emphasize something. This is a study bill. Police work is complex, and there are financial, administrative, cultural, and interpersonal issues involved in changing practices. I recognize that. I am not looking for a hasty mandate, but for figuring out how to do it right. But I also have to emphasize that this process really has to start now for the sake of our communities, including for those who protect us from the bad guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jen, for bringing that forward. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you. Thank you for your bringing it, and thank you for your testimony. Eric Gadlicks and Lorraine Algemeyer, Engelmeyer.
Good Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Skablix. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known as DPSST. What we wanted to do is go back a little bit in time and share with you what has happened over the last few years in the state of Oregon regarding this important issue. As many of you on this committee probably know, earlier in this decade, the Attorney General at that time, Hardy Myers, pulled together a work group to look at use of deadly force by police officers. That resulted in a 47-page document called When Duty and Life Collide, Comprehensive Approaches to Peace Officer Use of Deadly Force. The culmination of this work came in front of this legislative body in the 2007 session with the passage of Senate Bill 111. As many of you know, that established guidelines for the investigation and review of use of force incidents statewide. As a result of Senate Bill 111, DPSST worked with our stakeholders groups, the sheriffs, the chiefs, the Oregon State Police, and we developed and delivered training across the state for first-level supervisors as well as command staff. This specifically dealt with use of force issues and how to investigate use of force incidents. We also work with the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center out of Glencoe, Georgia, to adopt their best practices regarding this important topic. We continue to work with partner agencies that are not law enforcement related, for example, the Law Enforcement Contacts Committee, the LECC, the National Association of Mentally Ill, the Alzheimer's Association, and the Attorney General Sexual Task Force, to make sure that our training meets and exceeds the expectations of our communities. We are the provider of basic training for city, county, tribal, and state law enforcement officers. We do have some concerns with House Bill 2955. The first is the use of the term escalation criteria for use of force. Since August 2009, we discontinued training on use of force or continuum matrix. With approval of our police policy committee, we replaced it with a greater emphasis on objective reasonableness and totality of circumstances standards in our basic training. These legal standards for use of force incident are based on U.S. Supreme Court and Oregon Revised Statute. Language also within House Bill 2955 would move DPSST from our current role of a statewide basic training provider in the one that looks at how local agencies handle individual use of force incidents. These incidents involve local community and agency standards and local policies procedures, all of which are the responsibility of the local law enforcement agency and outside DPSST's purview. We understand the importance of House Bill 2955, and we look forward to working with you. There is a fiscal impact if we are to do research in this area, and I brought along today Lorraine Engelmeyer, who's our legal services coordinator, and she is one of our two co-authors on our use of force curriculum. We'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Is there any questions from the committee? Representative Garrett, please.
Can you say more about your first bullet point about the Supreme Court case law that, based on which you've decided to move away from the escalation criteria? I'd just like to know more about that.
Okay. Representative Garrett, I'm Lorraine Engelmeyer. Good afternoon. What the first bullet point is intended to address is the fact that our recent decision to move away from an emphasis in basic police training on the what is frequently called, and it's a matter of jargon really, a use of force continuum or a use of force matrix, is to allow greater emphasis on really what ought to be the primary influence in use of force training, which really is the Supreme Court standard. The United States Supreme Court really in the mid to late 80s issued the primary constitutionally based case law which drives this field of law. And those two cases are Tennessee versus Garner and Graham versus Connor. Subsequently, the Ninth Circuit has issued cases which for Oregon and the other states within the Ninth Circuit would be required to abide by any further nuances that the Ninth Circuit has imposed, but really those two cases are key. We've always trained on those two cases, but we felt it would be more prudent to place greater emphasis on them as they guide and rule this important subject matter area.
What were those cases called again, sir?
Tennessee versus Garner, issued in 1985, and Graham versus Connor, issued in 1989. And really, Graham versus Connor is the key case because the issue in Tennessee versus Garner is quite a narrow one. Graham versus Connor really is the case which speaks to all issues alleging police use of force.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, panel. We look forward to getting this thing a little more work done on and see if we can't improve what's going on.
Thank you
very much. close the public hearing on House Bill 2955. What else was there? Then we'll open a hearing on House Bill 3075. Call Representative Hunt, please. And Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. Just so we're all clear, because you do have two different bills, one 3057, one 3075. This is 3075 that is before us, which would require the installation of ignition interlock devices upon a first offense as a condition of DUII diversion agreements. This is really very much focused on how we can prevent further DUIIs. I think we all know that the more we can invest in policies and practices that prevent the commission of crime, the better off we are from a fiscal standpoint, from a human standpoint, from a community standpoint. So this would, and I encourage you to make sure you're focused on the Dash 1 amendment, because that's the latest version that Representative Thatcher and I have actually merged two bills together and hopefully taken the best of both bills, which were very much very close to start with. So the Dash 1 amendment directs the courts to require the installation of ignition interlock devices as a condition of driving while under the influence of intoxicants for a first offense. Current statute requires that only upon conviction, which is typically at the point of a second offense. The violation of this would be punishable by a fine, a Class A traffic violation. It also, importantly, and I think Representative Thatcher will speak further to this, directs providers of ignition interlock devices to report the installation and removal of those devices, so there's an accountability mechanism. As you all are probably well aware, in 2010, over 9,300 people in Oregon were convicted of a DUII and required to install an ignition interlock device. Unfortunately, only one-third of those people ever actually installed the device, thus the need for the accountability mechanism. But that 9,600 people doesn't count the thousands and thousands of folks who committed a first offense, where there's right now no requirement. There's only diversion. There is no requirement for an interlock device to be installed. So by creating stricter enforcement and stronger guidelines and reporting, we believe that we can make sure that Oregonians stay safe and sober while on the road. Again, as I said, House Bill 3075 is very much focused on preventing DUIIs under the theory that if stronger enforcements and penalties are there for the first offense, not waiting to the second offense or the fifth offense or the tenth offense, if they're there for the first offense, then we will be much better off. I would note that there may be a small fiscal that comes with this through DHS. DHS administers the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund, which is used in cases where indigent offenders are required to install these devices. If we add more people into that pool, there may be an additional fiscal. I would also note that on the plus side of the bill, because it also generates dollars through the fine for those who do not comply, there is both a plus and a minus, and I'm sure you all sort that out through the fiscal process. But I would strongly urge your support of House Bill 3075, and I'm proud to turn things over to my partner in this bill, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, please.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, State Representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg. And I'm guessing everybody in this room knows somebody or has maybe a relative who's had a drinking problem. And I have a cousin who's in another state. He has struggled with this. He's a recovering alcoholic. And I just wanted to talk to him. Well, what works? Does suspending your license work? He says, no, that's a discussion for another day. But he did say that there was a law in Washington that worked. He said it kept me accountable. He said that blowing before you go kept me from driving. That's what he said. And I say that is something we need to improve upon here in Oregon. We have laws, but we can make them a little bit stronger. So, talking with different advocates, I think there are a few behind me who are going to testify to this. But it works out that installing one of these devices allows somebody to get their license back. It allows them to be productive members of society, allows them to go to work, take care of their kids, et cetera. And it just provides another safeguard to protect the public as well. It just boils down to a simple theory, and that is people drink and drive because they can, and interlocks can be effective in stopping this from happening. Now, for those of you who don't know or haven't seen an interlock device, I have one with me. It's like a mini breathalyzer. It's about the size, as you can see, of a cell phone, and it's wired into the car's ignition system. And before the driver can start the car, they have to blow into the handset. And if the person's alcohol content is above a certain point, the vehicle won't start. And technology is evolving, and some of them will actually have running retests so that while the person's driving down the road, they have to blow at regular intervals to ensure they're staying sober behind the wheel. Today you'll hear, like I said, from a number of folks who know more about this, the particulars on the ignition interlock systems, than just about anybody else in the whole state. And I've also asked members of the Governor's Advisory Council on DUII to be here today. There's also a representative from the pilot program in Lane County, and where they've already been requiring interlocks for offenders on diversion. I've also invited a mom who lost her son to a drunk driver last fall, and this driver was on diversion at the time, and he did not have an ignition interlock installed. And I'd also say there's some people here from ODOT and from the Department of Justice, and so if you have questions, I'm sure they'll be able to address those in better detail. I've provided a few handouts. I don't know if you have them in your possession yet, but the first one looks a little bit like this. The latest figures from ODOT showing that there are more than 9,000 Oregonians who are currently required to install the ignition interlocks when they get their driver's license back because of a DUII conviction on their record. However, only 3,200 of them actually get them installed. So you're asking about what's the difference? There's 6,000 people who don't have them. Well, we can only speculate at this point, but the experts we've talked to believe many of these folks continue to drive anyway with their suspended licenses, or they're just waiting it out. They're waiting out the time period required to have an ignition interlock device installed and then applying for their license after that time has run out. Behind this piece of paper is a picture of somebody, you know, using the interlock device. There's also a colored map behind that, shows the ignition interlock laws throughout the nation, and you notice there's one orange state, that would be us, and it shows that they are mandatory, but it's only for convictions. Just pointing that out one more time. Today, there's about a dozen states that use ignition interlocks for every convicted offender. There's 11 states who require it for BAC, or blood alcohol content of 0.15 or higher, and there's 7 states that require it for repeat offenders. Then we put together some statistics for you to consider behind that, having to do, just point out a couple things, that currently about half of the DUII arrests result in a conviction, about half get diversion. And according to ODOT, about a third of all fatal traffic crashes in Oregon involve a drunk driver. The last page in the handout is a schematic the staff at ODOT put together. It shows the various things that happen to someone arrested for drunk driving in Oregon. The bottom left explains how the current ignition interlock laws work when applied to someone facing a conviction, DUII conviction. Just background, 1986, California was the first state to try a pilot program, but here's what I think is really cool. In New Mexico, they started the first mandatory law, 2003. They now have the highest number of interlocks installed per capita, and you say, so what? Did it work? Well, yes, it did. Between 2002 and 2007, alcohol-involved crashes dropped 31%, and the recidivism rate for DUII went down 37% in New Mexico. They've also seen a 75% lower re-arrest rate when compared to the non-interlocked offenders. And get this, even 85% of the offenders who are charged with getting, you know, you have to go get an interlock device. They said, you know, it's a fair sanction, and it did stop them from drinking and driving. And I think that tells a lot. These devices have been available for judges to in Oregon to use as a tool to combat drunk driving. However, it's rare that it is actually used.
It's only for convictions that you'll see it used. Rarely for people on
diversion. Most drunk drivers arrested for the first time are offered the diversion instead of a conviction, but they don't usually have that interlock.
So it's cost-effective deterrent, as shown in New Mexico quite nicely, and has proven results in reducing the
recidivism rate and also increasing the safety for people in the state. So, you know, there are people that talk about how can't somebody just game the system and blow into the device and fool it? Well, the technological advances are moving along, and there's a lot of improvements being made. But meanwhile, not knowing exactly what great technology is going to be out there, I think Oregon needs to take the next step and require those on diversion to have these devices. It works.
Thank you. Are there any questions in the committee? Thank you, representatives. Appreciate your testimony. Tom Irwin and Benita Howard, please.
Mr. Chair, I have a process question. Are we not going to have amendments distributed by committee administrators in this committee? Because I don't have a dash one to this bill. If we're not, that's fine.
And Chairperson, members of the committee, and Representative Schaffler, they're available on the shared drive. This one went out some time ago, but we can get you a hard copy.
Mr. Chair, I don't need a hard copy. I just need to know how to come prepared. If we're not going to be handing out hard copies, then I'll just have it in my file when we get here.
Wouldn't mind.
If you have one, I'll take one now, too.
Ms. Howard, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Benita Howard. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving. Sure, where Tom Irwin is, but he may be attending to other business. House Bill 3075 changes in Oregon's current ignition interlock device law. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence has been involved in IID discussions and in developing recommendations for more than a year, and we welcome the attention that this program is receiving in this session of the legislature. We understand from what Representative Thatcher and Representative Hunt said that you will be considering amendment to this bill. And our committee had an opportunity to discuss the proposed amendment when we met on March 4th. The amendment does change the bill in that it would now apply to all those entering a DUII diversion agreement with court. The current law allows the court to require an IID, but does not mandate it. Under the Dash 13075 amendment, the court must require, as a condition of the diversion, that an IID be installed during the period of the agreement when the person has driving privileges. A caveat, there is a period they can't drive because of the implied consent suspension that if they refused or failed that test. Violation of the provision of the agreement, of the provision of the agreement, could lead to the agreement, the entire agreement, being terminated by the court, and to a Class A traffic violation if the police cite the driver without the device installed. Under current law, that is a maximum fine of $720, I believe. The amendment would increase the number of drivers eligible for an IID. And you probably will hear today some of the same concerns expressed at our meeting about potential costs when an IID mandate is applied to a diversion. Our committee supports this proposed amendment because we believe that the primary goal of an IID is to provide the mechanism that allows these offenders to continue to drive legally with a proven tool to monitor compliance with the requirement the driver is stays sober when that driver is behind the wheel. The opportunity to enter into a diversion agreement spares an offender from some of the consequences of a DUI conviction, but the offender is expected to change his or her ways. An installed IID is intended to. And we've all heard in the news about agreements internationally that we refer to as we'll trust but we'll verify. I think in a way a DUII diversion agreement provides the state with a way to trust offenders to take the steps needed to assure that they will not reoffend in the future as a drinking driver. And the IID is the tool to help verify that the driver stays on the course. The Advisory Committee on DUII therefore urges your support for passage of an amendment and the final bill, House Bill 3075. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for Ms. Howard? Representative Wisniew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Howard, thank you for your letter and your testimony and your work on this important committee. You said that you're concerned about the cost of implementing this program. However, isn't there a lot of money in the Intoxicated Drivers Program Fund that we can pay for those people who could not afford to pay for this system?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar with how much money is in that fund. I understand it may have some questions about how much money is available, but we think the consequences of not getting the problem corrected, if that takes an increase in the intoxicated, there's a method of collecting money for that fund, and if that may take an increase, but the numbers we saw after we had our discussion last Friday, we don't believe the cost will be that great.
Thank you for that testimony, and I'm glad you made that last statement. You don't think the numbers will be that high. Committee members, remember the fee bill we're talking about? There's a fee, existing fee, I understand, is $25 now, and is proposed to go up significantly in that bill, which is still being worked. But I also understand that there is significant amount. Is DHS going to testify, Chair, Mr. Chair?
I'm not sure DHS, but I have a number of people. Yeah, they are. Yes, they are.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Hey, thank you. I'd like to call Jay Hall, Scott Healy, and Susan Lair. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Scott Healy. I'm the Senior Deputy District Attorney in Clackamas County. I'm here testifying on behalf of Clackamas County, also the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're here to support this bill, I think, maybe for obvious public safety reasons that people who drive under the influence of intoxicants are a significant safety risk to Oregon citizens. Many people, as you know, are arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, and many of them are first-time offenders. Probably about half of them go on diversion. A lot of these people have high blood alcohol content when they're stopped for the first time, which would suggest a significant problem. And so this would be a way to monitor them, even though they're on diversion, they're not convicted of the crime, or at least initially they plead guilty, and then obviously if they successfully complete diversion, then they're not going to be sentenced and convicted of the crime. In Clackamas County, we have a number of these people that will go to meetings, and we have Clackamas County Sheriff's Office deputies there in the parking lot, and they pull in, and oftentimes they have been drinking alcohol, even though they're on diversion, and if there were a ignition interlock system, this would obviously be a situation where maybe those people wouldn't drink and then drive to these meetings. I really don't have much further to say other than we very much support this bill, and we hope that you pass it along to the floor. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jay Hall. I'm an assistant district attorney in Lane County, and I'm here to testify for informational purposes. 2010, I have the statistics from Lane County, and Lane County had the ignition interlock device pilot program. In 2010, we had 1,293 DUI cases in Lane County. 485 of those defendants found themselves diversion eligible. Out of those, 174 out of 485, our office, the district attorney's office, made the decision to file a motion to ask the court to implement an ignition interlock device as a condition of the diversion. Now, we had four criteria that we were looking at, and they're quite high criteria before we even asked the court to implement the ignition interlock device. And those four criteria were that a person be either under the age of 21 with any amount of alcohol, that a driver be over 0.15, the use of intoxicants added to a crash, a motor vehicle crash, or that the person had a past diversion or past DUII, but were for some reason eligible for DUII diversion again. So if a person had any one or more of those four criteria, then our office would ask the court to implement an ignition interlock. So out of the 1,293 and 485 that were diversion eligible, we asked for it on 174 times. 14 of those were denied. 160 people were ordered to put in ignition interlocks. Now, I don't have the result of that. I don't know how many people actually went out there and put the ignition interlock devices, because if they're not going to drive, then they don't have to put the ignition interlocks in there. For the most part, I would say three judges in Lane County applied our criteria, applied the prosecutor's office criteria. One judge would deny any of the motions if they were based on a percentage of BAC that was less than 0.08 and it was a minor. One of the judges would decide it based on the defendant's self-reported financial issues, and several of the judges would implement their own criteria, but it was quite higher than the state's. For example, they would only make them have an ignition interlock device if it was 0.18 or 0.20 or higher. So for the most part, the judges down in Lane County were along the same lines as the district attorney's office, and they required ignition interlock devices using our criteria. And with that, I don't really have anything more to add to this other than I'm here available for questions.
Barker and co-chair Krieger and committee members. My name is Susan Lair, and I'm the executive director of Oregon Impact. We are a prevention education organization aimed to stop impaired driving, and we also conduct the Clackamas County Victims Impact Panel, which you heard referred to earlier. The Victims Impact Panel is one component of the requirements for someone who has been arrested of a diversion or arrested for DUI on diversion, or if they received a conviction. It's a panel that we do every month. We average 170 members at that panel every month in Clackamas County. Every single month, there is someone who comes under the influence. And almost every month, someone is rearrested for a DUI because they chose to drive to the panel. One of the things that we know with the Clackamas County Victims Impact Panel is that many people on diversion are headed for a second DUI, or worse, a tragedy that they cause because of their decision to drink and drive. We are in support of House Bill 3075, and we hope that you continue to pursue this and pass this legislation, because we believe that not only does it make a difference to prevent reoccurrence of DUI, but it is an immediate action that directly affects the behavior of what they have been arrested for, and that is their driving. We also believe that most people don't even understand how little much alcohol can impact their driving. As a prevention education organization, we work with people who don't really understand that two drinks can cause harm to somebody else. It's really a misunderstood situation. So we encourage you to give consideration, because we think the ignition interlocks would go a great deal of a distance to help those first-time offenders be educated as to the risks that they are causing when they get behind the wheel, and encourage them to make the right choice. Thank you, and I welcome any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Wan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This might be a question for staff, but I'm just curious to know what the cost is for installing one of these devices.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Wand, I'll defer that question back to the speakers. I don't actually.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, my information is that the cost of one of these devices is approximately $75. There are about five different private companies that will provide those down in Lane County. It's $75 to get it installed, and it's roughly $40 to $50 a month to maintain it.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So, gentlemen, we heard previously that two-thirds of the people who are supposed to put on the devices don't do it. So what happens to those people? I understand that if they decide not to drive, of course, they don't have to put it on a car. But obviously, many of those people are still driving. So what are the consequences if they don't put one of these devices on their cars currently?
Well, are you talking about people that are on diversion or people that have actually been convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants? The people that go on diversion?
Well, we just heard of the previous speaker that people who were required to do this, two-thirds of them don't do that, don't put the devices on their cars.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, people find themselves in different situations when they're driving under the influence of intoxicants. If they have a prior DUI diversion, as you know, then they'll get a conviction. If they're on a first conviction, they get a one-year license suspension. The year following that, they're required by department rule to have an ignition interlock device in their vehicle at that time. If they don't have an ignition interlock vehicle and they're found driving, or they tamper with the ignition interlock device, their driver's license suspension is simply continued for the remainder of that year. At the end of the 2 years, then they're eligible again to drive. It's the same thing on a second DUI conviction when they're facing a third 3-year suspension, and then on a lifetime revocation, if after 10 years they've kept their driver's license clean and they go back and their license is reinstated, they have a 2-year period where they have to have the ignition interlock device. And if they tamper with it during that time or don't are caught driving without it at that time, then again it's simply the license suspension continues for the remainder of the 2 years. So it is quite a toothless remedy that the court
right.
has.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're Representative Wistand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hall, we passed this bill, I think, 2 or 3 sessions ago to start the program, but I understand now you talked about how there's 5 companies in the Lane area. What kind of feedback or how do we know and who's monitoring if anyone's tampering with the devices or or broken them or whatever? How is that reporting done and how to be sure that the people are not disengaging it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett. Well, the answer to that is they're not reporting it to the court, and they're not reporting it, obviously, to the district attorney's office. It is reported to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and that is a mandatory report by statute. And again, the only remedy there then is that they're continued on their license suspension.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Next call, Ann Craven. Reed
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt. I'm testifying on behalf of Mothers Against Drunk Driving in support of House Bill 3075 with the -1 amendments. I'm also a member of Crime Victims United, and Crime Victims United is also 100% in favor of House Bill 3075 with the -1 amendments. Thank you to Representative Thatcher and Representative Hunt for bringing this very important bill forward, which would expand Oregon's ignition interlock program. MAD's support of ignition interlocks for drunk drivers is simple. It's about saving lives. In Oregon, there's approximately 25,000 DUI arrests, and it is estimated that there are 11,000 of these that result in diversion, thus creating a loophole where an offender is free of an interlock requirement. It's often referred to as a get-out-of-jail-free card or free pass. MAD supports this bill. It would close this loophole. Countless studies have shown ignition interlocks are the most highly effective tool to stop drunk driving. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, found that ignition interlocks reduce repeat drunk driving offenses on an average of 67%. And an ignition interlock is a breath test device, and you've already seen one, so I'm not going to repeat that. It's set at a BAC. In Oregon, it's a 0.02, so they have to blow above the 0.02. If properly administrated, the IID could save thousands of lives and give offenders the ability to drive while not endangering the public. Expanding ignition interlock laws for 11,000 people who may receive diversion instead of a DUI conviction will help keep the streets safer and lead to more interlock usage. The results are clear from New Mexico with the use of interlocks. There's far less instances of drunk driving. In my testimony that I turned in, there's a chart that clearly demonstrates that. House Bill 3075 is also economical. It's an economically sound public safety measure. Every life saved or injury prevented by the device translates into millions of taxpayer dollars who no longer subsidize drunk drivers. In Oregon, it costs $1.2 million for each drunk driving fatality. The drunk driver, it needs to be noted that the drunk driver would be paying for this device, and the taxpayer would no longer be burdened with subsidizing drunk driving. The interlock acts as a virtual probation officer riding in the front seat. Multiple studies on interlocks for both first-time and repeat offenders show that interlocks reduce repeat driving instances by an average of 67%. 88% of the public supports mandatory ignition interlocks for all convicted drunk drivers. We know the average first-time offender or arrestee has driven before. The most conservative estimate, or study, I should say, is a drunk driver getting on the road at least an average of 87 times. I've even heard as much as 2,000 times. You will also hear talk about punishing those who are one sip over the legal limit. The illegal limit in Oregon is 0.08. The National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism notes that to get to a 0.08, a man must consume 5 or more drinks and a woman 4 or more drinks in a 2-hour period. This dispels the myth that someone can be arrested for DUI after a beer at a ball game or a glass of champagne, at a wedding. Drunk driving is a violent crime that is 100% preventable. Oregon can improve on its current mandatory ignition interlock law by closing this gaping loophole, which allows drunk DUI offenders to avoid an ignition interlock while receiving diversion. Passing House Bill 3075 will close this loophole and will help reduce drunk driving and the senseless injuries and violent deaths on our roadways. House Bill 3075 is not about punishment. It's about retraining risky behavior. It's also no longer about the drunk driver once they decide to get behind the wheel drunk. It's about the safety of all Oregonians. Mothers Against Drunk Driving urges this committee to support 3075. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to introduce Larry Thornton.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Grieger, and all other members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and speak today.
Could you just say your name for the record, because they have this on tape?
Larry Thornton.
Thank you.
I was getting that.
Okay.
I live in Reedsport, Oregon. I am a mother. I am the mother of Joshua Thornton, who was killed by a drunk driver September 18, 2010. I am strongly in support of the House Bill 3775 that requires all those on diversion to have installed in their vehicle an ignition interlock. The National Transportation Safety Board stated, in 2009, people identified as hardcore drinking drivers, those with high blood alcohol level concentrations of 0.15% or greater, or who are repeat offenders with a drunk driving arrest or conviction in the past 10 years, were involved in more than 70% of the alcohol-impaired driving fatalities and more than 22% of all total highway deaths. Repeat offenders represent one-third of all driver arrests or convicted of driving while intoxicated or under the influence of alcohol. While these people that are in diversion, we don't know which ones will be the repeat offenders. In addition, there are those in the diversion program that do not take the program information, videos, or personal experiences seriously. Therefore, continue to drink, hoping not to get caught. They are in the mindset that this won't happen to me. House Bill 3075 would eliminate the tragedies caused by those who don't recognize the severity and possible deadly consequences of their decisions. In the Tyler Davis, Josh Thornton, Nick Schneider tragedy, Tyler Davis was one of those who did not take diversion seriously. If Tyler Davis had been required to install an ignition interlock, House Bill 3075, while on the diversion, Tyler Davis would have never been able to leave the first stop, the Waterfront Bar in Reedsport. Most likely, he and his friends would have walked to a friend's house in time, called for rides home, and that evening been together with their families. Five young children, who included Josh's son and two stepchildren, would still have their friend, their dad, and their hero. Our son Josh was a passenger in a 4x4 Dodge Ram, which was driven by Tyler Davis, who is in the diversion. Being in the percentile of offenders who did not take diversion seriously, consumed a few alcoholic drinks at the Waterfront Bar in Reedsport, and then decided to drive to Florence, a town 20 miles away, his hometown, to patronize a couple of the bars in Florence Waterfront, where he knew a couple of the female bartenders. Again, Tyler Davis, ignoring the protocol of diversion, got behind the wheel with Josh in the passenger front and Nick in the back seat. On their way back to Reedsport, they proceeded southbound for approximately 4 miles, then turned left on Canary Road. Only 3 miles up Canary Road, approached a bend in the road at such a fast rate of speed, the truck climbed the bank, flipped over itself end over end, landing on its wheels, again throwing out its passengers onto the pavement, only to be crushed by the rolling truck. Tyler Davis was a prime candidate for an ignition interlock. The House Bill 3075 would have prevented the tragedy that occurred on September 18, 2010. These offenders don't just slip through the cracks and go unnoticed. They eventually kill people. I feel through our advancements in technology, the ignition interlock device is a tremendous device that should be used to its full advantage and has the capability to save hundreds of lives. The loss of Josh has drastically changed our family's lives. We struggle with the ability to move forward, concentrate, sleep, exercise patience, the desire to interact with others, to feel any excitement or peace. Our life has become very complicated. We have 3 lawyers, a lawyer for the wrongful death, a lawyer, a probate lawyer, and a custody lawyer. We are not only financially responsible for our own home, but also for Josh's, which is currently in probate. My husband, Steve, feels the financial burden of the situation, coupled with the grieving, and he never smiles. Shauna, Josh's girlfriend, is depressed, angry, and impatient, and doesn't see the purpose or need to go on. My focus and priorities and responsibilities have totally changed as well. Before the crash, besides working full-time, I was enrolled in Western Governors University to further my education. I was going to go to, I also coach cross country and track. There is no time for school now. Josh's son, Braden, is my top priority. He is very needy. He does not want to be by himself. He doesn't want to play by himself. He doesn't want to take a bath by himself. He doesn't want to sleep by himself. And at night, he wakes up every night with dreams. Josh had full custody of Braden, and they were always together. They were best buds. His best friend now is gone. The custody of Braden would naturally go to the biological mother. Many of my evenings are now spent journaling, making journal entries, typing documentation, emailing lawyers, reading lawyers' emails, printing out affidavits, copying affidavits, reading affidavits, creating a photo album for an hour presentation of Braden's life as we are filing for full custody, and it takes a lot of time to build the case. The tragic crash of September 18th has changed the lives of our entire family, each trying to cope with the loss in their own way. It has been 6 months since the 18th of March, and our family is continuing to struggle through the grieving process, going through the motions of living life with a feeling of numbness. None of us know when we'll be able to not be so self-absorbed in our grief that we can feel joy, peace, happiness, or excitement for life again. In closing, I feel House Bill 3075 could save a family from the grief and sadness and pain that our family is suffering. Plus, it is critical for the safety of others to pass this bill. It is a necessity step in the diversion. We need to know we have done everything we could in eliminating the next fatal tragedy, as there are many other Tyler Davises out on the road. In good conscience, how can we not pass Bill 3075? Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, friend. We understand how difficult. We can only guess how difficult your testimony is, but we really appreciate you taking the time to come down and share with us. Are there any questions from the panel? Thank you very much. Doug Harkle Road, Charles Roberts, Indiana Ryerson. Okay. Just go ahead. Start, please, and remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thanks, sir. My name is Charles Roberts. I'm a resident of Clackamas County. I'm here to testify in favor of this legislation because of a number of reasons. One is that the Center for Disease Control recently reviewed 15 studies, scientific studies, about the use of the ignition interlock. That study is, their cumulative study is to be published in the American Journal for Preventive Medicine this month. In that study, the review of 15 studies, all of which said that the ignition interlock device will prevent and reduce recidivism among drunk drivers, reduce drivers' crashes, and is just in general an overall good thing. The Center for Disease Control also takes note of the fact that 11,000 people are killed every year by drunk drivers. If the Venezuelans, for example, had killed 11,000 Americans last year, we'd probably nuke them into dust. I want to tell you about my own experience. When I got back from my second tour in Vietnam, my mom came and visited me. She was happy. She saw my little preschool-aged daughter. She knew my wife was pregnant with another child. And after her visit, she went back to San Diego. And with my stepfather, was proceeding southbound on a freeway, going out to dinner. A man driving a pickup truck came going northbound in the southbound lanes. I guess he thought he was on the right-hand lane because he was about to center punch my stepfather's car. He pulled into the center divider as far as he could, but it wasn't quite far enough. The camper on the back of the car impacted the passenger side of the vehicle, peeled the roof back, and decapitated my mother. I learned later that this adverse driver had previous convictions of drunk driving numbering in the teens. The number 17 comes to mind, but it certainly was a minimum of 13 previous convictions for drunk driving. And his blood alcohol was pretty astronomical. Some years later, I became a deputy district attorney in Southern California. Didn't tell my colleagues about it. Didn't let anybody know. But I was able to get behind drunk driving cases and prosecute them to the full extent of the law within the parameters of my boss's procedures, whatever you call it. Fortunately, the active district attorney was one of the member of the President's Commission on Drunk Driving, so he was pretty strong on drunk driving, too. I prosecuted several hundred. I must have had 30 or 40 jury trials. And I also prosecuted people for driving while their license was suspended. And I used to have a lot of good friends in the law enforcement when the person was told, you know, you've been driving with your license suspended and you can't drive anymore and you're put on probation and don't drive anymore. I would often have one of my friends in law enforcement follow the guy out to the parking lot, and as he drove off, my pal would arrest him, bring him back in front of the same judge 15 minutes later, and we'd see just exactly how long he's been in custody. This device is not perfect, I'm sure. Nothing in human life is. But it certainly beats nothing. And the societal costs of 11,000 deaths a year nationwide are crushing, if you think about it. I mean, my mother's dead. My stepfather could never resume work. And it's just one instance. I mean, that guy hit 8 different cars before it finally came to rest. And then people talk about blood alcohol levels like 0.10% is somehow just piddling, you know, hardly worth talking about. I used to have a California Highway Patrol officer, young, strong, strapping fella. I used to love to have him testify because I'd have him come in and I'd say, okay, Officer Rich, I still remember his name. I understand you took part once in a controlled study which you drove through a bunch of cones on a closed course and then you were given enough alcohol to get you up to a 0.10 and drove through the course again. He says, that's correct. I said, how'd you do when you were sober? I said, this is fine. He says, how did you do at a 0.10? He said, I didn't. So why is that, Officer Rich? He says, because I passed out. So when you hear about a 0.10 and you look at a strapping young California Highway Patrol officer passing out at a 0.10, it's not exactly a heck of a lot of alcohol. And yet it's enough to render this fellow unconscious. I don't know what the solution is for drunk driving, but I do know that doing nothing is not the solution. So I urge you to adopt this law, adopt another law, adopt as many laws as it takes to reduce the carnage from drunk driving. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. The Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance strongly supports House Bill 3075, the -1 amendments. I shan't take much time, and you can certainly read everything I wrote, which is somewhat of a summary of everything you've heard today. But what I would like to do is to tell you that I've been doing this since 1974, and I know some of you have been doing it equally as long or maybe longer, starting as a beginning deputy DA. And here's what I know, is that we will not solve the intoxicated driving problem with one simple spear. It's going to take a whole series of spears to do that, and we're moving in the right direction. We are moving in the right direction. And so I have been actively working on this a long time, and the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance has this as one of its major platforms. I'm pleased to see that Jay Hall, who was a student of mine, testified about the pilot program in Lane County. We started that under my tenure. It shouldn't be a pilot anymore, and it won't be a pilot anymore if House Bill 3075 passes out of this committee and makes it through the legislature. So we need a variety of spears. This is one more good one, and I'd recommend you pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks.
Mr. Harkelrode, thank you for your testimony, and this is a technical point, but I think you're the man for it. My reading at the moment of the bill is that it would apply to all DUI convictions under 813-010, including controlled substance DUIs. That's my reading at this point. Do you have any thoughts on that? Does the Anti-Crime Alliance have any thoughts on that?
I think that's right. Chairs and Representative Hicks, I think you're right about that. It would apply to controlled substances. And while you might think that, well, wait a minute, controlled substances aren't measured by interlock devices, which is true, what we also know is that individuals who use controlled substances also use alcohol in combination some of the time. And so I would suggest that reaching to the controlled substance is a good thing. The other thing I would say about that is that I'm a victim of a drunk driver. Sunday afternoon at 4:30 in the afternoon, I'm one of the lucky ones in 1987. And that lady had marijuana in her system, and she was about a 0.14, as I recall, alcohol. So there's the proof right there.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Roberts, for your testimony. I would say that in days gone by, I've been involved where people are out drinking and then come in and take a breathalyzer as somebody drive them, and they didn't drive themselves. As an experiment, in the off-duty police officer, never was any, I mean, they would say, we'd ask, what's your estimation of where you're going to be? They'd say, 2.0, I'm really hammered. Maybe a 0.06 or something. So your point is well taken.
I would like to clarify, Officer Rich took that as part of his training at the California Highway Patrol Academy.
They run labs here in Oregon, too, and the same people that get people to volunteer to test, and they're always surprised at how low that number is compared to what they imagine they might be. And another important aspect, I think, of this that we haven't talked about yet, the alcoholic is in denial for the most part. And so by having this interlock, that would pretty much require them to stay sober for a while, and they might then realize they do have a problem which they haven't been able to realize prior to that time. Representative Krieger.
You mentioned you started in 74?
Yeah.
I think I started in 64, and it's 40 years this year that I've been involved either here or in that uniform. And we hear these stories. We saw it in our communities. We saw it down in the Chetco at Brookings. You could bet every May the kids would go up the river prior to graduation, and we're going to lose one or two. It was just like clockwork. And there's a lot of grief in those families. that grief doesn't ever leave the family. They've got it the rest of their lives. Okay. No free questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, Karen Wheeler, please. Is there anybody else here to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. Listening to the testimony has been very interesting today, and I would support pretty much everything that everyone said. We are neutral on the bill. However, conceptually, we're supportive of interlock devices. I'm testifying on the impact of this bill to the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund. The Addictions and Mental Health Division currently manages that fund, and that fund not only supports ignition interlock devices for people who can't afford to pay, but it also funds treatment for indigent folks and interpreter services for people who do not speak English or who are hearing impaired. Currently, the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund represents $900,000 per biennium. I would point out that prior to 1999, it represented about $5 million per biennium. Our contract currently with the vendor that provides the interlock devices to people who are indigent is worth $115,000 this biennium. This represents a significant increase over last biennium, in which the contract was worth about $17,000. This growth corresponded with the growth in the number of Oregon adults who are eligible for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. And in the statute, that is the eligibility criteria for getting access to the indigent funds to pay for the interlock device. This bill would increase the number of people having to get the interlock device, and you've heard estimates of the people on diversion ranging from 10,000 to 13,000 people per year. The following assumptions were used by us to help determine the impact on the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund. 15% of Oregon adults are eligible for the SNAP program. Based on the compliance history, which you've heard earlier, of one-third of those who are required to get the IID do so, this would mean an additional approximately 450 to 600 people per year, or 900 to 1,200 people per biennium, who could potentially access the indigent fund to get the interlock device. And this could impact the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund by an additional $207,000 to $276,000 per biennium. I would like to point out that in Section 1, lines 20 through 26 of the bill.
The amendment.
I'm speaking of the bill. I believe that language was carried forward in the amendment. That section eliminates the court's authority to mandate the IID if there's insufficient funding in the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund, which could be interpreted to mean that the Addictions and Mental Health Division would have to pay regardless of the amount of funding in the IDPF. So as I pointed out earlier in my testimony, the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund pays for primarily treatment, indigent treatment. So anything that expands the IID and expands that contract would have to be taken away from the treatment budget. House Bill 2104, which your committee heard on February 3rd, would increase the fee paid into the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund and would reestablish the health or sustainability of that fund, helping to pay for interlock devices, as well as treatment and interpreter services for DUI offenders who are unable to afford those services. Again, thank you for the opportunity today to testify on this bill, and I'd be happy to work with any of the committee members or answer any questions at this time.
Thank you. Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Are there administrative rules that set a standard for when a person who is required to install an IID can receive funds from the state to assist them in that?
Chairs Parker, Krieger, and members of the committee, Representative Wand. There are currently no administrative rules that have been promulgated by the Addictions and Mental Health Division for that point. The statute is very clear and specific in that people who are SNAP eligible, or they're eligible for what used to be called food stamps, are eligible to receive the interlock device full cost, basically. So our contract currently pays $53 for the installation of the device and then around $50 each month for the lease fees for anyone who's eligible for SNAP.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So there's no, once you're eligible, what I think I just heard you said, and I want to clarify to make sure I understood it. If you're eligible for food stamps, you have a car, drive drunk, get convicted, judge says you need an IID to protect the public. Under current law, that gets paid for by the state. And that's correct?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Wong, that is correct. So the person presents their eligibility to the contractor who currently provides the interlock devices, and they get that device installed.
One last question, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you. So, and it would require a statutory change to make it clear that installation of the IID is intended as a sanction for driving under the influence? Is that what it would require? If we wanted to do that, hypothetically? Maybe that's a question for Mr. Knott.
And if I may, co-chairs, members of the committee, yeah, this is an interesting problem within this statute, because one of the mechanisms that exists right now is one that allows the program basically to be suspended if there's insufficient money in the fund. So if things get low, it just turns off, and that's being deleted wholesale. So in the new system, I mean, if there's not money there and you have an indigent person, I mean, just in the confines of this statute, they're going to be required to, we're going to have to pay for it if they can't.
Follow up. That was actually, thank you, Mr. Knott, that was the point of my question. What if we were to decide that as a policy matter, we don't want to pay for these and we want the person who's convicted of driving under the influence to have to pay the cost themselves? What would that take to enact?
And co-chairs, Representative Wand, the problem with that is that, and this is something that I perceive as being plenary across the criminal justice system, some of the participants in diversion are going to be well and truly indigent. A court mandate that they need to pay won't generate anything. And so in that instance, I don't see there being a statutory fix that's essentially going to say that people that cannot pay have to pay. So I'm not aware of what you would do here. How it's handled elsewhere is that the judges have discretion to waive fees, but the way this is crafted now, that wouldn't be available.
One last, I'm sorry, Mr. Co-Chair, I appreciate your deference here to me, but isn't it the case, though, that under this statute, if they don't have the IID installed, that then they lose their license and there are other sanctions, and that part of going into the diversion process is proving that they installed the IID?
And
they want the diversion, right?
And last remark I would make, co-chairs, Representative Wand, and again, this is something I would follow up on with legislative counsel, but there was some discussion on that issue. My concern there would be, at the point that you craft a remedy, a diversion option and interlock ignition devices that are, as a matter of practical reality, only available to the people that could pay for them, I think you'd be seeing some challenges to that program in court.
under the equal protection of the law, under the law. So you run into some constitutional issues with that. We've run into those in the past.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we need to get it short.
Okay, but this does touch on some kind of subtle policy questions that this policy committee is going to have to evaluate. And what Representative Juan's line of questioning was, what I was hearing, and this is something that we should think about, is, you know, most of our witnesses here, I think, have presented these devices as being, frankly, less punitive than preventative. And so, I mean, do we as a state, especially in this fiscal period of tight, you know, times, do we say, well, the preventative impact of these things is worth paying some extra money, public funds from the court fees and assessments account, but this is a policy question that we need to wrestle with. I mean, I understand that we don't want to be showing out a lot of tax dollars to pay people's punishment. This is something we should think about. Additionally, what I'm hearing here, a witness say, and please correct me if I'm not hearing it correctly, is that we'd basically be looking at taking a reduction of $207,000 to $276,000 from indigent treatment, which also is, you know, a preventative measure, in a sense, you know, in a treatment one, too, versus punitive. And so I see you nodding. Is that right, that basically we implement this, that means indigent treatment is going to be reduced by $207,000 to $276,000, meaning people who get convicted might not get treated?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, and Representative Hicks, that is correct. And this current biennium, we had to move not a whole lot of funding, but we did have to move some funding from treatment, the treatment side, of which we commit some of the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund, over to the Interlock contract, because it grew pretty substantially.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It seems to me that this question raises two dichotomies. First is the mandate for these devices intended primarily to be a sanction, as Representative Juan suggested, in which case I think it's a legitimate question whether the state should pay some people's fines and not other people's fines, or is it really a preventative mechanism, in which case I think you have the same debate. Why should public funds be used to pay prevention in some vehicles but not in all vehicles? And secondly, it gets to the whole notion of whether driving is, as I understand it to be, a privilege rather than a right. And if it is a privilege, then someone who violates the safety required, regardless of their economic status, forfeits that privilege, and if they want that privilege back, I'm kind of with Representative Wand that I'm not sure that it's good public policy for us to assist them if they've broken the trust that is given to them to keep the roads safe.
Sorry.
Which doesn't go to, I support the underlying bill, but it's a question of how we pay for it.
I agree. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Indeed, and whether, I mean, because the thing about these devices is the car doesn't start if they blow bad. And so what we have to weigh is, you know, and what these witnesses, I think, are what I'm picking up from them is, you know, could these tragedies have been prevented if the person had not been able to start the car? And so then we have to weigh, do we spend tax dollars on that? Is that really what we're doing here? I'm just putting that out. That's what I'm hearing that is going on in this underlying issue. Okay.
And Mr. Co-Chair, if I might, it's my understanding reading the bill that the mandate, if the bill becomes law, then the mandate is that any vehicle that person in a diversion program might drive has to have this installed. So one has to interpret that if there is another vehicle registered at the same address that person lives, that vehicle belonging to a spouse or a girlfriend or boyfriend or a son or daughter or an in-law would have to have this device. Any vehicle that they might possibly drive at work has to have this device. I'm assuming for some people we're talking about more than one device.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, is this referred to Ways and Means? Have a referral.
Uh, co-chairs, members of the committee, I did not see one coming in. I would be stunned if it doesn't end up there.
Mr. Chair, I have really some concerns about DHS's reporting of how much money and how much has been diverted and all that. I think this is a top priority program for the safety, public, the safety of the public, and we ought to really look at the money and see if we do have enough money. I understand it's a 90-10% split. Maybe, you know, we find that this is a more effective program. We may want to change that number, but also want to see how much we're putting into that. So I will be glad to talk to Mrs. Lillian.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3075. In the interest of time today, we'll take a look at those amendments at a later date. I'll hand off my...
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3057. And Representative Hunt and Daugherty, please.
Can I make one comment?
Yes.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, just briefly, House Bill 3057 eliminates the statute of limitations for crimes against committed against minors. The reason I'm making an opening is I want all members of the committee to be aware that there is a fairly significant amendment that has already been filed, which would change, by my reading, the applicability of this bill from all crimes committed against minors to a very brief enumerated list, which is contained within the statute. If you don't have that amendment, please give me some sort of a signal.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. I think as you think about House Bill 3057, in my mind, the most important perspective is that there should be no timetable for justice when you think about victims of child abuse. The House Bill 3057 would eliminate the criminal statute of limitations for specific crimes against minors. And as your committee administrator has stated, the original bill was drafted in a way that was not as quite as tightly fine-tuned as the Dash 1 amendments. But we are dealing with eliminating that criminal statute of limitations. To make it clear that the effects of child physical and sexual abuse are lifelong, and that having an artificial cap, be that 3 years, 6 years, 12 years, 20 years, having an artificial cap on access to justice for these victims of abuse should not be in the law. I am not a victim of child abuse myself. We have several victims who will come and share their stories today. I am a parent, as are many of you, of two young kids, and my wife is the director of the Child Abuse Assessment Center in our county. And this is true in every one of our counties across the state. We have just unbelievably tragic examples of child abuse happening in our communities. We don't like to talk about it. We like to mask it over. In our county, the victims who come in, are over half of them are age 7 and under. 70% of them are sexual abuse, the other 30% being physical abuse. We have a tragic, tragic situation that we need to take really seriously. And this bill comes to you from Co-Chair Barker, Representative Daugherty, and myself to acknowledge that right now there is no avenue in some cases for these children to seek justice because of the current statute of limitations. House Bill 3057 will remove the statute only related to minors, only in cases where the abuse has occurred when they are minors, and only under the Dash 1 amendments for those specific crimes listed in subsections 3 and 4 of the bill. It will allow victims and survivors to find closure, justice, and hopefully some peace in their lives. I should note that House Bill 3057 applies only to offenses that take place after the law's effective date. That's all we can do. So it would not allow prosecutors to open old cases. And I would also note that we're not breaking new ground in House Bill 3057. At least 10 other states already have zero statute of limitations on these horrific crimes against minors. I would note that even in the Dash 1 amendments, there is one additional item that may need some additional amendment. It could be read that the amended version of 3057 unintentionally loops in crimes where both parties may have been minors at the time of the incident. And so I certainly support, I think Representative Doherty and Co-Chair Barker support making it clear that this is applying where you've got an adult and a minor, not two minors, not two adults. But I think you're going to hear some powerful testimony on this bill to again, make it clear that there should be no time clock on justice for victims of child abuse.
Thank you very much. Representative Margaret Doherty out of House District 35, Tigard and King City. I come to you from a little bit of different perspective. I also am not somebody who has been abused, but I was an educator for 10 years, worked in the education system for another 22, and even after retirement still work with high school students through the peer court in the city of Tigard, run through the police department. And so the issue with this is to protect children. And even as long ago as I taught, back when the woolly mammoths roamed the earth in the mid-70s to the mid-80s, I had high school students that had been sexually abused, but back in the 70s and 80s, we didn't talk about it, and the kids didn't talk about it. But they did talk about it 20 years later, and the effects that it had on them, period. And so what we're looking at, you know, it's time to take this step with so many of the victims to seek justice for them. And like Representative Hunt said, it's not that we're... I mean, there are certain safeguards, there are certain protections, you know, these kind of things, but whether it's something happened 10 years or 20 years ago or 7 years ago, I think it's very important that it be brought to the forefront. This is a change that is needed in the law. It's not that we don't have safeguards for abused minors now, but it doesn't go far enough. To age 24, to age 30, or to age 40, it needs to go even further than that. You know, some crimes are so heinous that time just does not heal them. And this is what we're hoping that this legislation will at least begin to get some sort of retribution and help. Because the bill is proactive rather than retroactive, it really won't, we don't believe that it'll create a lot of a legal mess. And what we're also looking at is that these are statutes that are in other states or statutes at work. I think the most important thing is we have got thousands and thousands and thousands of victims that because of the circumstances when they were young minors or when they were teenagers, the crime was so heinous they just don't come forward. We realize that there's a lot of legal ramifications in this, but I think this is the sort of legislation that we need to look at the type of crime that it was, and to make sure that the victim does eventually get some sort of rest.
Committee, any questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Doherty, thank you both for bringing this bill to us, but I'm a little bit confused. You say the bill is not retroactive?
No, the bill is not retroactive. In other words, if a crime happened prior to this bill being passed by the legislature, it does not go back to that. It's okay. Just from this forward on.
Okay.
This point on.
Thank you.
From what I understand.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further?
Anything else?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have 17 people that are going to want to speak to this bill. So if you all take 10 minutes, we're not going to make it by 3 o'clock. So try to condense what you can. If you've got written testimony, summarize it briefly. I'm going to go ahead and start at the top here. Be Randy Ellison, Kelly Clark, and Vaughn Tidwell, please.
Chairman Krieger, Chairman Barker, distinguished committee members. My name is Randy Ellison, and I drove here from Ashland, Oregon today to testify on this, what I consider, historic bill. I volunteer with several organizations that deal with child abuse, but today I'm here as a citizen, and I'm here as a survivor of child sexual abuse. I don't believe there's anything that you can talk about more important than the statute of criminal statute of limitations on abuse of our children. A few years ago, in my recovery, I wrote the following words, and I don't think they've ever been more applicable than they are today. Hundreds of years ago, it was common in some cultures to perform human sacrifice. The thought of it repulses us now. How could people allow it? But it occurs today in the form of child sexual abuse. Our government and each of us allow it to happen by our inaction. The sexual abuse of children has and is robbing our society of millions of potential teachers, leaders, and contributors to a better society. Most victims don't tell what happened to them for years, and then it's frequently only after years of therapy. In my case, I first told someone what happened to me at age 57. We were reminded of a case a few weeks ago by an article in the Oregonian. The victim's life was destroyed. The promise she showed as a teenager morphed into addictions and failures. She literally wasted away and died at age 42. What did her perpetrator have to say about it? He said, oh gosh, she was 15, not 13. And he's a man of wealth and power, and today is unpunished for this crime and always will be. At least 13 other states do not have a statute of limitations on child sexual abuse. And if you were ever a victim of child sexual abuse, you know why. Last week, the state of Washington House passed a similar bill, House Bill 1657-98-0. And I ask that you send a message that Oregon stands up for our children and supporting children and pass this on to the House with full recommendation by this committee. I want to thank you for being able to testify today, and I don't think that I've ever done anything more important than be here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kelly?
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chairs, member of the committee. My name is Kelly Clark. I'm a lawyer in Portland. In 1989 and 1991, I had the very great privilege of serving in this House, including serving on this committee, and so it's nice to be back in front of you. Since about the mid-1990s, a significant portion of my law practice has been representing children who were abused and adults who were sexually abused as children. And I'm here in support of the bill and appreciate the sponsors and their leadership. I've probably met with 500 adult victims of child abuse in the last 15 years and probably represented maybe 300 of those people. They tell me I put it on the back burner. Oftentimes, I should say, I'm the first person they've ever told. And they will tell me, I put it on the back burner. I swept it under the rug. I put it on the top shelf. I had a man tell me, I pretended it didn't happen. Had another man, very high-powered federal law enforcement officer, tell me, how could I have been damaged? Look at me. Look at my job. Look at my wife. Look at my kids. How could it have affected me? And here he was in his late 30s talking with me. The mental health community can tell you why this is, what happens to people, but the reality is that very few victims come forward until they're well into their adulthood. I liken it to the perpetrators placing a pill in the mouth of the child that somehow causes the child to go to sleep, at least a portion of the child's mind, and wake up only decades later. And so the bill is necessary if we're serious about justice for children. As the prior, someone mentioned a minute ago, you can't constitutionally go back and make this retroactive, so it will only apply into the future. That's the reason, I think, for the bill being prospective only. But at the very least, it's something we can do to even the playing field between the victim and the perpetrator. I'll just close with this. Oregon, since I've been watching Oregon politics, we have always been at the forefront of legislation protecting children. We passed some of the first child abuse reporting laws in the nation in the 70s. By the early 80s or mid-80s, we had amended our civil statutes of limitations. In 1991, I co-authored a bill that outlawed for the first time in any state the possession of child pornography. It was written by then District Attorney Harkleroad and was upheld by the Oregon Supreme Court. We do things in this state to take care of our children. This bill, on the other hand, is long overdue. And I would encourage your passage of it and be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Respected Representatives Barker and Krieger and members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Vaughn Tidwell, and I am here to speak in support of House Bill 3057. Because these comments are very difficult for me, I would ask that you please bear with me and allow me to read my comments instead of looking you in the eyes. It will be a little easier for me to tell you what I need to say. Nothing in the world is more devastating than childhood sexual abuse. It destroys lives. Not just the life of the victim, but also the lives of many others closely or distantly associated. It is the most horrific, devastating, and injurious attack anyone could perpetrate on another human. One never recovers from the trauma. One merely tries to cope with it for the rest of their life. I know this. I am a victim of childhood sexual abuse. At the hands of my scoutmaster, I was abused several times. I buried it for years, building walls so thick no one could break them down. I survived by staying constantly busy and let no one close to me. I was an emotional recluse. I could foster no meaningful relationship. My anger was frightening. My confusion was severe. My life was an uncontrollably altered mess, and I did not even know it. For 40 years, I successfully buried the memory. Then a trigger incident brought it out of its hiding place in my brain, and I relived the trauma all over again. Suicide was a real option. The realization my life had been destroyed threw me into a depression I would wish on no one. For 40 years, I lived in a surreal world. Then I was forced to face reality. The healing process is painful, arduous, and exhausting. One cannot even imagine what it is like, and it lasts for a lifetime. One of the things I do to help overcome the trauma is to help other victims. It didn't take long when I started talking to my friends and my past for me to discover I was not alone. This predator had ravaged the lives of several of the scouts. Some are now dead. Some are addicts. Some are alcoholics. All are damaged for life. You can imagine then my astonishment and grief upon discovering that this predator, who had devastated so many lives, lives free of justice. He'll never face prosecution or fear incarceration for his crimes against Boy Scouts in my group. He lives and enjoys the freedoms of a now retired man, totally insulated from his deeds in the Scout troop by a rule of law called the Statute of Limitations. A crime as devastating as this deserves no such immunity. I pay the price of this crime every single day of my life. The passage of time alone should not bar the prosecution of an evil of this magnitude. It should not make any difference if the victim realizes the damages 5 years, 20 years, or 40 years after the attacks. The victim has a right to see justice served without this protection for the criminal. So do all the other people damaged by the horrific deed. No one who has sexually molested the most vulnerable of souls should be able to walk a single day on this earth free from the reach of justice. These predators bring so much suffering to so many. The victims, the families, and the general public deserve to be able to prosecute this crime without any legal loopholes, allowing an escape from justice. The statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse should not exist. I implore you to pass this bill. It will not help those of us badly hurt from the laws of the past, But we as a society and the victims that now suffer for life will all feel a sense of relief knowing that children of the future will have the right to seek justice regardless of any arbitrary timeline. Thank you very sincerely for your time. If you have any questions, I will happily address them.
Committee members?
I didn't have a question.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, for you. Civil versus criminal, two different animals. Both of them have different standards for proof. Now we're looking at this issue for criminal. I'm trying to figure out how, with time elapsed, and let's say 20 years, how is a law enforcement agency or how is a district attorney to be able to retrieve all that evidence from an incident that occurred 20 years earlier to be able to bring it forward for a conviction? I mean, it just seems like, you know, because of the evidence that existed, I'm just trying to bridge that, if you can help me.
Right. Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Olson, this is a problem with any old litigation. It comes up in the civil cases all the time. Perhaps Mr. Foote from Clackamas County District Attorney, the District Attorney of Clackamas County, may address it as well. In cases of murder, for example, where under the murder statute there's no statute of limitations, same issue. So what it means is, I think you can take some comfort in the fact that it will only be the strongest cases that will get prosecuted, because after all, prosecutors have discretion. They don't like to lose, because they like public to understand when these convictions go down what happened because of the deterrent effect of the law. So prosecutors will always have the discretion not to bring a case that they think is unwinnable. The criminal standard, of course, is quite high. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. And so, yes, there are proof issues, but they are addressed in the criminal justice system both by the nature of the burden of proof and also by prosecutorial discretion. I have met many survivors of child abuse who, were I a prosecutor, I would not hesitate to rest an entire case upon their testimony alone and let a jury of the citizens of this community decide beyond a reasonable doubt or not. We trust those people with lives and liberties all of the time. So I think the guarantee is in prosecutorial discretion and in the jury system itself.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further? Thank you, gentlemen. We are down to 11 minutes for about 14 people. I'm going to call up the next two that are on the list, and then they will be people who support the bill. I'm going to have to give it a minute or two to those who maybe oppose it or at least want to just talk about their concerns with the bill. So let's have Steve Dole, D.D., is it Cohen? Cones? Countens? Coons? And Christine Landers. Please come up.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'll make my comments very brief based on the last witness. You can't add much to that when it comes from first person. I can tell you this, that my experience has been in advocating for victims, that the most difficult stories I have ever heard are stories like that gentleman just told. I don't understand it. It's a hard thing to wrap your arms around, any crime, person-person crime that's committed that injures another person, but sex crimes against children are the most difficult. As many of you on the committee know, my daughter was a murder victim. Her life was taken. But these people who have sex crimes committed against them as children, it's also a murder. It's a murder of their soul. And with that, I will end my testimony. Thanks very much.
Representative Barker and members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to be here today. I don't have a prepared speech, so I will be brief. Hard for me to do. I've been involved with criminal justice.
Can you give us your name? Can you give us your name, please?
Pardon? It's D.D. Coons. K-O-U-N-S.
My husband, Bob Coons, and I were the founders of Crime Victims United in early 1983. And our daughter was a murder victim down in California, and we had spent 2 years of the most intense investigation, found out all kinds of things about the man that murdered her and his cohorts, and finally ran out of some energy and money and all other kind of things and came back to Oregon. And soon found out, got our nose involved in legislation and our representatives and senators of our district, and we soon found out that Oregon was just about as bad towards victims as California. And that was a big shock to us. And we decided to find out why. Why were victims considered just a nuisance in the whole area of criminal justice? And that's the truth in 1980. And from there on, we snooped and studied and worked and talked to everybody that we could think of in every way involved with criminal justice. And we soon became very aware of what a tremendous, awful, terrible effect that particularly sex crimes had on children. And I can't even begin to know myself how many hundreds of victims of sex crimes that I have become a friend, have become a listener. The effects on their lives are tremendous. Sex crimes affect every area of our society. Rich people, poor people, people of every religion and race, everything. We went in part of the education to the prison, and we talked to Lifers Club and Lifers Panel, and we did that for about 4.5 years. And it wasn't because we are not apologists for criminals. Please don't believe that we are. What we were is we were still trying to find out that why. And it was an education process. And then later years, we were asked to be counselors for intake kids at McLaren. And we did that, I think, 2.5 years, something like that. We were supposed to be educating the kids, and what happened was kids educated us. Criminals, people who are of that nature, take statute of limitation as a path. And that cannot be. It only encourages criminal activity. The man that murdered my daughter, although he was in California, was a criminal for all the days of his life. And he took advantage of every kind of pass like that. So I congratulate you who are sponsors of this bill. And I want to thank all the people who have testified today. I know how very difficult it is. Even though I have not been a victim of child abuse, our family was victimized by almost every kind of crime there was. And we have to stop this. Our society cannot exist in giving a people a pass for doing sex abuse or any other crime for that matter. I feel like the statute of limitation is about that's all it is. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, forgive me for I have to go to another committee, but I support the bill, and I thank everybody for coming to testify on behalf of us.
Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. Chair Krieger,
Co-Chair Barker. My name is Christine Landers. I am a prosecutor at Clackamas County DA's office. I've been there for approximately 16 years. I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association as well as the Clackamas County DA's office. And Representative Olson, I think I can address the question that you posed to Mr. Clark during my testimony. I would like to speak about this bill. The ODAA does support this bill, as does the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office, particularly as it has been amended in the Dash 1 amendments. It's my understanding that the bill applies at this point exclusively to felonies. The felonies all relate to child sexual abuse except criminal mistreatment in the first degree. That statute does specifically relate to physical abuse or neglect of children. And I would suggest that that is also appropriate for an exemption from the statute of limitations. Someone mentioned earlier that an amendment would probably be helpful to ensure that these crimes, that the extended statute of limitations applies only to adult offenders or individuals who offend as adults, not to sort of co-juvenile offenses, and we would support an amendment to that end as well. I want to talk also about the question of retroactivity just for a moment. It is my understanding that the way that the statute of limitations bills typically work is when you extend a statute of limitations, it does apply retroactively to cases that have not yet expired. The statute of limitations today is the age of 30 if the case has not yet been reported. So any report prior to the date that the victim would turn 30 would be prosecutable. It's my understanding that typically if this bill were passed, any victim who has not yet reached the age of 30, their case would be extended as well. If they have already turned 30 and the statute of limitations has elapsed, the case is not revivable, and so it is over. But generally, these bills do apply to acts that occur retroactively but that do not extend the statute or do not revive a case that is sort of legally dead, so to speak. And that's my understanding of how this bill would be intended to work, or that's at least my understanding of how these bills typically work. And until I heard Representative Hunt's comments, that's how I thought this one would work. So that's just something to think about, I think, in continuing to discuss the wording of the bill. I want to just mention that these crimes are unique. I have prosecuted child sexual abuse crimes since approximately 1998. These cases are unique. They're unique in many respects, I think the most important of which is that victims of this kind of crime almost uniformly feel shame. It is very, very difficult for them to come forward. The statute of limitations in Oregon is trending in the right direction. I mean, we've gone from 24 to 30, and now in this instance, we would go to no statute of limitations at all. And that's in recognition of the unique nature of these crimes and the difficulty that victims have in reporting. I want to just briefly mention two cases that I have experienced where we were unable to prosecute fully an offender who had offended individuals where the statute of limitations had run. In one of those cases, it was an individual who had sexually offended three of his children. Two of his two older daughters were beyond the statute of limitations. He could not be prosecuted for the abuse of those two girls. And those two girls had attempted very diligently to shield their youngest sibling from abuse by him, and they largely succeeded. The number of crimes that he was prosecutable for were not nearly what he had done. I'd also bring up that just last week we had a detective contact my office to talk about whether or not a case could be prosecuted where a woman had been molested by her father as a young teen and she was now 40, and the case is simply not prosecutable in spite of the fact that it is provable because he fathered a child with her. Now, just briefly, I'm going to talk about provability. These cases...
But we're down to about 30 seconds.
Okay. These cases are always difficult to prove. Your question, it's not that much different for a case that is far in the past, and the burden of proof would remain the same. I don't have anything further to tell you, and I apologize for taking up the last of your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I think we're out of time, but what we're going to do is carry this over till tomorrow. We want the rest of those who are able to come back. I know it's an inconvenience, but we also want those people who want to discuss opposition to the bill or their concerns to be able to come back also. So we'll carry it over until tomorrow.
And we'll close the hearing on the bill for today and we'll adjourn the committee.